from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today, high-tech food designed to survive the extremes of weather in the era of climate change. We talk with journalist Amanda Little, author of the new book, The Fate of Food, What We'll Eat in a Bigger, Hotter, Smarter World. Little visited the world's largest vertical farm, where leafy greens are grown inside without sun or soil. Some of the places she reports from are a military lab developing a bot that prepares food through a 3D printer, a factory that makes freeze-dried meals that are stockpiled by survivalists and people fearing tornadoes and hurricanes, and a startup whose founder is growing meat cultured from animal cells.
It struck him that if human tissues could be grown for medical purposes, why couldn't animal tissues be grown for food?
And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews his favorite album so far this year. Climate change is affecting the weather, and droughts, floods, storms, and unseasonal temperatures are affecting the global food supply. Tech startups, as well as mega companies, are developing new, high-tech ways of growing vegetables and fruits, farming fish, and growing meat without harming animals. 3D food printers, laboratories where meat is grown from cultured animal cells, robots that can weed crops without using chemicals, and indoor farms where vegetables are grown without soil or sun are some of the new approaches investigated by Amanda Little in her new book, The Fate of Food, What We'll Eat in a Bigger, Hotter, Smarter World. She's traveled to 13 states and 11 countries researching changes in our food system. Her reporting on energy, technology, and the environment has been published in the New York Times, the Washington Post, Rolling Stone, and other publications. She's a professor of journalism and science writing at Vanderbilt University. Amanda Little, welcome to Fresh Air. Tell us some of the ways in which climate change is affecting the global food supply.
Well, let's just start in my own region. I live in Nashville, Tennessee, and we've heard recently that in the Midwest, in Indiana, Kansas, Missouri, Illinois, Iowa, there have been terrible storms and tornadoes that have had huge impacts on grain production, soy and corn in particular. I think they've said that there's a historic delay in the planting season because of the sodden fields. The farmers just simply can't plant their soy crop because they have their, you know, there haven't been enough dry days. And the same goes for corn. In the past 5 years, in 18 states that produce the majority of corn, had 90% of their plant in the ground by now, and they have only about 55% because of the rain and flooding. So that's just sort of one example of, you know, the subtle changes that farmers are having to deal with, in this case related to flooding, but drought, heat, invasive species and insects, diseases, crop diseases and so forth have been affecting virtually every, farm in the world.
So this made me think. You write that the greenhouse gases that now threaten the future of the world's farmers are also largely produced by the farms themselves, especially the big mechanized ones. Would you explain that paradox?
That's true. It's sort of agriculture has got us into this mess, and now climate change is biting back. And I will say, you know, agriculture is one of sort of many aspects of modern civilization that's, contributing to the, global warming phenomenon. But I believe food production is responsible for about 15 to 20% of total greenhouse gas emissions globally, which is about as much or more than all transportation forms combined. And, there are huge fossil fuel inputs that go into food production and certainly into, both the farming and the distribution of that food. And it results also from livestock production, methane emissions from livestock production. So there's a cumulative effect that's been very intensive. And by the way, it goes beyond, emissions themselves. I believe it's 70% of fresh water used by humans flows to farming. Agriculture has altered, you know, every inhabited place on Earth. And we can see the impacts of agriculture probably more than any other human activity, not just in climate change, but in the way that it's transformed rivers and lakes and land. So it's a story that's been building for millennia, since, you know, the dawn of civilization, and it's really coming to a head right now.
So big agribusiness companies, some of them are starting to invest in this new technology. I guess there's a couple of reasons. One is that it might have big payoffs in the long run, but also they're worried about the problems of climate change, and some of this new technology can kind of circumvent some of those problems. But there's also people from the sustainable food movement who have kind of joined this like high-tech future. And some of the people who you write about who were in the sustainable food movement decided after a while that the movement couldn't provide enough food and couldn't provide it at affordable prices. So basically they were growing food or raising livestock to feed a few very prosperous people. So a few people you write about decided that wasn't enough for them. They wanted to do something that contributed more to a larger group of people and with affordable prices.
That's right. It was really interesting to me, for example, when I spoke with these folks at Blue River Technology and was really concerned when I heard that this scrappy young startup that was here to disrupt the agrochemical industry was being purchased by John Deere. And I said, you know, aren't you concerned that the agribusiness folks are going to kind of squash this insurgent idea? And they basically said, no, the pressures are so significant that we need to collaborate with big businesses to scale this quickly, because, you know, in order to get very expensive robotic weeders on the ground, you need scale and you need to make this affordable and accessible to not just U.S. farmers, but farmers all over the world. And we don't have, you know, we need to do this in 5, 10, 15 years. This is, you know, we're facing such severe challenges and pressures ahead.
Well, let's talk about some of the new high-tech ways of farming. Let's start with vertical farming. This is a form of indoor farming. Give us the basic description of how it works.
So I visited a farm in Newark, New Jersey, that's located inside an old warehouse that was once a laser tag arena. And it's in sort of an industrial part of Newark. And I walked inside and entered this sort of Blade Runner-esque sort of cathedral of indoor plant production. They grow leafy greens for now, but eventually other kinds of high-nutrient foods on trellis structures, or these stacks of trays that go up about 30, 35 feet high, metal trays. And the plants are not grown in soil, but rather they're grown into a fabric, and the roots dangle down into a nutrient mist that is continually nourishing these roots. There are other forms of indoor food production that is not aeroponic, as you call this one, but hydroponic, where the plant roots are dangling in a water solution that's continually kind of cycling through. But in this case, aeroponic indoor production has the advantage of growing plants with about 90% less water than, you know, conventional in the soil lettuce production or crop production. And that, of course, can be a big advantage in water scarce areas. The lights that are radiating down from right above these trays of little leafy greens that I saw are a mixture of blue and red spectrum lights that can, combined with sort of extra oxygen that's pumped in, and extra CO2 that's also pumped in into this along with this nutrient mist, can cause the plants to grow 30% or more faster than they grow in the field.
So plants don't necessarily need soil to be fed nutrients. They could get the nutrients in other ways.
Precisely.
Mm-hmm. So why is it mostly leafy greens that are being grown in vertical farms right now?
Great question. Well, I mean, the leafy greens, the baby leafy greens that you buy in the supermarket, baby spinach and arugula and so on, sell for about, $4 or so a box, and they grow very quickly. They wilt very quickly, so they're mostly grown. Lettuces are mostly grown in Salinas Valley in California and in Yuma, Arizona, and so they have to be trucked long distances and refrigerated. They're mostly water, so they're very vulnerable to wilting. And as we know, they're vulnerable to diseases, E. coli and so on. So the water intensity of that crop, the high cost of those baby greens, and the, food security challenges around growing greens and transporting them long distances makes it a really great crop to do in a local vertical farm, because there are a lot of costs saved, even though there are a lot of costs added when you're doing indoor farming.
So I'm wondering if the leafy greens taste any different when they're grown indoors like that, if you tasted any of it. And are stores selling it yet? Can we actually find that, or is this still very much in the experimental phase?
Oh, yes, they're selling it everywhere. So I was expecting it to be pretty bland and sort of floppy, as, for example, if you get the hydroponic lettuces that are in those sort of plastic shells that have been available for a long time. I've always found them to kind of lack flavor and lack sort of structure and texture. But the ones that I tried, interestingly, in the Arrow Farms facility were really peppery and bright and even crunchy and tasted to my palate anyway, as good as anything I've had from soil. What's interesting too is that they're monitoring these plants and what they need and how they grow with hundreds of thousands of data points. And so they can actually sort of dial up and down certain characteristics of these plants. So if they want it to taste a little bit more peppery, or if they want it to be a bit sweeter, or if they want the leaves to have a sort of reddish edge, or if they want it to, look or taste a certain way, they can actually add this nutrient or reduce this amount of oxygen or CO2 or whatever. And they can actually sort of control all these characteristics of the plant. And so they're learning eventually how to begin to sort of control terroir or the sort of environmental conditions that contribute to the flavor and phenotype of edible plants.
So there's a lot of advantages to these vertical farms. It uses less water than conventional farms. No pesticides are needed. You don't have to worry about the weather. No soils needed. What are some of the downsides?
there are many. It's interesting, throughout the reporting of this book, I was always sort of coming to terms with this, the risk or reward is often sort of neck and neck, and so there's something that's pretty absurd about the idea of growing food without soil and sun, and in particular sun, right? Because it's freely available to everyone, and to create artificial sun and use electricity to create artificial sun and grow plants, with that energy intensive formula, seems like it would be an environmental disaster, right? So there's some question as to whether, yes, it might be much more water efficient, but how efficient is it in terms of fossil fuel inputs for the electricity, right? And certainly if you can have a solar-powered vertical farm or wind-powered or hydro-powered vertical farm, then you can offset the fossil fuel inputs that go into that production. And the sort of manufacturing of artificial sunlight. One of the other advantages, though, that the Arrow Farms folks are quick to point out is that this is a 24-hour cycle, right, of growing. The plants need to rest a little bit at night without sun, but they won't be interrupted by seasons, and they won't be interrupted by, bad weather or drought or whatever. So it's a much more sort of reliable supply of food. And if, as they have, located their production facilities near a wind farm or a hydro hydroelectric facility or, you know, solar panels eventually, they can get around the problems of the, you know, energy inputs.
So I'm just thinking, like, is beautiful farmland going to be paved over for vertical farming?
Well, they work in particular in, you know, dense urban areas, right? So the idea would not be to put these facilities in, you know, in rural areas, but instead very close to population centers, which is appealing given how quickly the world is urbanizing,
and then you eliminate the trucking costs and the fuel that's going to go into the air.
Exactly. So you're cutting some fuel inputs, and then you're adding some others. There are lots of different numbers on exactly the sort of cost benefit analysis from the energy input standpoint. But yes, I mean the vision is, look, if we can then take that, thousand acres that was growing arugula, or rather, you know, romaine lettuce, and we can do that in a facility next to, you know, an industrial wasteland in the outskirts of Newark, and supply those populations nearby, then we could return that rural area that was growing single crops to much more diversified food production, or even to sort of pre-agricultural forest land that would become a carbon sink, which is a very sort of romantic vision, right? Okay, we could turn sort of lettuce farms into forest lands and carbon sinks. Whether that will happen, is a stretch, but in theory, it's very interesting.
A lot of people have given up meat, and that's for several reasons, including they don't want to see cattle slaughtered. They don't want to see animals treated inhumanely in factory farms. They don't want the cholesterol of meat. So now there's like meat alternatives being grown, actually forms of meat being grown in laboratories. And basically it's from cloned cells, right?
So it's from biopsied cells that are removed from a living animal and then are cultured. So they are replicated in a sort of what they call a bioreactor, which is basically a very sophisticated crock pot. And the cells, live cells, are self-replicating. So they actually select cells that can continue to replicate themselves, which is a natural process. Cloning, I don't think, is quite accurate because cells do this on their own. That's, you know, how living creatures grow. The cells that are harvested and then cultured in the laboratory are alive. They're so alive that they, in fact, can flex or spasm, when stimulated. And this was really something that really got me both excited and sort of semi-terrified, honestly, about the prospect of eating this stuff. Was these cells are they're living cells. They're just not attached to a sentient being. And they, in fact, die when they're harvested from the bioreactor and then are not fed oxygen any longer. And the asphyxiation then kills the cells, and they are no longer reactive.
Got it. But does it have, like, the flavor of meat?
It does have a lot of flavor because what we're eating, I mean, in the meat we consume is just that. It's muscle, connective tissue, and fat. The meat that I tried, which has a lot of different names for it, we've heard sort of, you know, cultured meats is one way of putting it. Cell-based meats is another. Lab meats is another, but the laboratory meat that I tried was duck meat that had been freshly harvested from a bioreactor in Berkeley, California, in the headquarters of a company called Memphis Meats, which is not selling its products in the world quite yet, but has gotten lots and lots of investments from major meat producers, and there are lab meats that are companies producing lab meats that that are also doing lab-based seafoods. The idea is that you can essentially do any meat, any meat that came from any kind of living animal, whether it's livestock or fish, can be produced in this manner. As long as you can sample some cells and help them replicate and grow. And in my case, the duck experience was pretty staggering, because and I haven't eaten a whole lot of duck in my life, but what I did eat, which was just this kind of lump of duck meat with salt and pepper that had been sauteed in a pan, tasted very much as advertised, as meat. And there's a difference between the plant-based meat products that we're hearing about on the market, like Impossible, the Impossible Burger and Beyond Meat, and these lab meats, because the lab meats are identical on a cellular level to the meats we eat. So they're actual meat, but they're not, derived from plants. They're derived from the cells of animals.
My guest is Amanda Little, author of the new book, The Fate of Food. After we take a short break, we'll talk about 3D food printers being developed by the military. This is Fresh Air.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Capital One. Capital One wants to build a better bank, one that feels and acts nothing like a typical bank. So they're reimagining banking. They offer a great savings rate and accounts with no fees or minimums that can be opened from anywhere in 5 minutes. That's banking reimagined. Capital One. What's in your wallet? Capital One N.A.
Let's get back to my interview with journalist Amanda Little, author of the new book, The Fate of Food, What We'll Eat in a Bigger, Hotter, Smarter World. Before you tasted some of this cultured duck, you had to sign a waiver, and the waiver acknowledged that cultured meats are experimental and their properties are not completely known, and you had to agree that you accepted all risks of loss, damages, injury, or death that may occur as a result of your participation in this tasting. I was thinking, thank God I don't have to sign this before every meal. But did that give you pause? Because it's still so experimental, they can't really say for sure what the long-term effects of this are. I don't know how worried they are about problems that this meat might cause in the long-term future. But how did you feel about signing this?
You know, I didn't feel concern, in part because the use of stem cells in medicine and, cultured tissues in medicine has a pretty deep history. When Valetti got interested in this, he had been actually injecting stem cells, which are these replicating cells, into patients' hearts with the hope that they would sort of replace and regrow damaged tissue. And, you know, it struck him that if human tissues could be grown for medical purposes, why couldn't they, animal tissues be grown for food? Also, I will say that Valetti had assured me that his children had regularly eaten some of the fruits of his labor and research, and that they were perfectly fine. And I should have no qualms about this. And of course, I knew that he and his team and many others at, for example, Tyson Foods and elsewhere had tasted this meat before investing in it. So I was pretty calm about it.
So right now, cultured meat or laboratory meat is in its experimental stages. And it's very expensive right now, too. What do you think the odds are that it will be actually available and affordable anytime in the foreseeable future?
I think the odds are very high. I think it's interesting and important to kind of note that the basic technology for growing muscle tissue has been around for a couple of decades. And this is not, brand new stuff. But the work that's being done now, there are probably half a dozen or more startups that are getting very aggressively funded that are working on this and that plan to have products available in, by 2020, in the next 2-3 years. Valetti has been pretty careful about not putting, a release date on his products. But it's really a matter of scale and cost. And the cost has come down from hundreds of thousands of dollars, even for an ounce of this meat, to, a couple of $100 for an ounce of this meat. So it's moving very quickly, the progress on this.
Meanwhile, the Army is designing something that seems just impossible to me, which is like 3D food printers so that, you know, soldiers on the battlefield can have food that's lightweight and that can also be designed with the nutrients that they need. Give us a sense of what this is.
So the Army has been developing and experimenting with in this realm of, you know, non-perishable foods and sort of non-food foods for, you know, many, many decades. And they've been working with dehydrated, freeze-dried foods and, you know, foods in packages, meal MREs, meals ready to eat, and this kind of Soylent-style food that can go out into the field and not have to be refrigerated and can, you know, nourish a soldier with, you know, a few bites or a few gulps. And the latest thing that they're working on at the Natick Research Labs, which is where they do all the experimentation on Army foods, is 3D printed foods, which, as the scientists see it, will actually really improve the flavor and the nutrients they can get to the soldiers in the field, because A, they can be printed on demand on the spot and be sort of fresh in that sense. And B, they can be combined with exactly the kind of nutrient cocktail a specific soldier will need. The idea is that the soldier will have a sensor that's sampling, you know, or detecting in the soldier's blood if it has a deficit of potassium or needs vitamin C, and then can transmit that information to this 3D printer, which will then incorporate exactly the nutrients that soldier needs into a sort of food pellet or a food bar and print it out and get it into the field by drone or some other means.
Oh, by drone or some other. So in what sense is it a 3D printer?
So it deposits little kind of dots or squirts of food onto a plate inside a chamber. The current 3D printer, the one that I observed in the laboratories, looked very much like a microwave. It was called a Foodini, and it had cartridges of sort of paste, chickpea paste and avocado paste that are blended with, you know, special sort of nutrient additives. And they also use peanut butter variants and some other things that are essentially food pastes. They deposit it in either little dots or lines, like you're kind of squirting icing onto a platter. It looks like that. And then it can be kind of flash cooked with some heat or flash frozen into a sort of block of nutrients that can then be delivered to the soldiers.
How are things getting communicated from the soldier who has specific nutritional needs to the place where the food is actually squirted onto the tray and done whatever with?
That's right. So it's sort of like a glorified Fitbit, you know, with some sensor that's testing the, now they already have sensors that test the sweat of the soldier, and they can get all kinds of biometric information from the chemistry of the sweat. But essentially some sort of Fitbit device would be able to interpret from the sweat or fluids or blood of the soldier what exactly the nutrient needs are of that soldier at that moment, and then transmit that, yes, wirelessly to, you know, base camp or wherever this printer is. And then the printer gets the information and begins to concoct these pastes.
Did you taste any of this 3D printer food?
I did. I tasted 3D printed chocolate peanut butter cups, which were delicious. I tasted, we had a 3D printed flatbread that we attempted to make that was a sort of chickpea sort of base, and then with this Army star printed on top with an avocado paste. So it was supposed to look like sort of avocado toast. But the 3D printer sort of malfunctioned. It disobeyed military orders and got a clog and had all kinds of problems. But it was very interesting because the scientists were very sort of patient with this, as you might be with a toddler. and, you know, said, it's just learning. It's learning how to do this. You know, it's learning how to purge a clog. It's learning how to do this. And, you know, they're using AI, you know, artificial intelligence and robotics and very complex technologies to teach these printers how to produce these, you know, this food that they want ultimately to produce. They feel that it's very feasible. This will be in the field by 2025.
Let me reintroduce you. If you're just joining us, my guest is journalist Amanda Little. Her new book is called The Fate of Food, What We'll Eat in a Bigger, Hotter, Smarter World. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air.
We'd like to thank our sponsor who brings you this message, Discover, who alerts you if they find your Social Security number on any one of thousands of risky websites. Discover believes there are some things you just need to know. It's just another way Discover looks out for you, not just your account. And best of all, Social Security alerts are free for Discover card members. All you have to do is sign up online. Learn more at discover.com/free alerts. Limitations apply.
If you need to be reminded that we're all more connected than we realize, get the StoryCorps podcast and restore your faith in humanity. Uninterrupted conversations between real people about the things that matter most. And this season, in honor of the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall Uprising, we're highlighting voices of LGBTQ people across America. Stories from those who lived before Stonewall to today. Episodes are available every Tuesday.
My guest is journalist Amanda Little. She's the author of the new book, The Fate of Food, What We'll Eat in a Bigger, Hotter, Smarter World. Now, you say that the most surreal place that you visited on your tour of like new high-tech approaches to food was a place that makes a new high-tech form of freeze-dried food that is being stocked up on by many survivalists right now. So describe this factory. Should I call it a factory?
Yes, it was the chicken pot pie room at Wise Foods facility in Salt Lake City, Utah. And they were producing little Mylar pouches of freeze-dried chicken pot pie that, you know, essentially can be shelf-stable for at least a quarter century, probably much longer than that. But this is what they call prepper food, right? It's the survival food industry, and this industry has been growing very, very quickly. In recent years, just in the last few years, it's more than doubled. So one of the concerns is that we're seeing sort of diminishing government safety nets while we see intensifying environmental pressures. And a lot of people are becoming more and more concerned that in our lifetimes, we will see, disruptions in our food supply. This was foreign to me because I'm not someone who have never stockpiled food in my own home. But I had relatives and friends, including my brother, who was a climate scientist, who was beginning to stockpile survival foods in the basement of his home. And I thought, what in the world is going on and how urgent is this problem?
So give us an introduction to how this food is made.
Okay, so the core technology is not actually new. The Wise company, and as do other, you know, survival food companies that do this freeze-dried food, they practice a sort of 21st century version of something that the Incas started in about 1200 AD. They placed potatoes and this kind of beef jerky on elevated slabs of stone, and they freeze overnight and then quick dry in the sun. Started doing this in World War II. The modern freeze-drying methods were created actually to preserve blood serum for wounded soldiers. I mean, the current processes date back to about the 1970s, and essentially it's called blast freezing. So there's these temperatures as low as negative 112 degrees. They prevent the formation of ice crystals that can affect the food's sort of texture and nutrition. And then they're put in this heated chamber that causes the ice to sublime. So it goes directly from a solid state into a gas without passing through the liquid phase. And this means that the foods retain their texture mostly.
So how worried should I be that your brother, who is a climate scientist, is starting to stockpile food because he's so concerned about the future of climate change?
That was the driving question for this entire book. How screwed are we exactly? I was kind of surprised because it wasn't just my brother who's a climate scientist. It was also other people in my life I was beginning to notice doing this. My stepbrother, who's a business guy who lives in D.C. and has a very urban life, was doing this in his own basement. My cousin-in-law, who lives in Indiana, is a former cop, was doing it at his home. And the company actually is targeting a new consumer they call guardian moms, who are worried about a stable food supply for their kids going forward. These are people who've lived through Hurricane Harvey and Katrina and Sandy, you know, lived through these once-in-a-thousand-year storms that are now happening sort of once every 50 years. They've lived through major blizzards, forest fires, flooding, and so on. And they're seeing interruptions in very local ways in their communities where they can't get to the grocery store for, a few days or more. And they're beginning to see that this might be the sort of new normal.
So what kinds of foods is the survivalist company making into a freeze-dried food that can last for a long time and help you through a disaster or catastrophe or whatever?
So they're comfort foods. There's, beefy chili and turkey tetrazzini and sort of stewy kind of comfort foods that you might associate with your grandmother or, it's the kind of food, as they say it, that can be high calorie and comforting in sort of an emergency situation.
And I guess you probably have to add water, so having it be stew-like is probably sensible.
That's right. I mean, when I tucked into my chicken pot pie, it didn't look anything like the Stouffer's version. It was sort of a tawny gruel, although it did taste very familiar to me. It tasted sort of like my grandmother's chicken casserole, and so it wasn't as off-putting as I'd like, although the notion that this would be my sole source of sustenance was pretty scary to me. And so when we think about a future in which we may lose access to these foods that are, so comforting and familiar to us, and we may have to resort to Mylar packages and 3D printers and Soylent and this kind of thing, it's really upsetting. This is a topic that people have a lot of emotion about and should. And it triggers this instinct for survival and innovation.
Have you changed or reconsidered any of your eating habits as a result of writing this book?
The single biggest change for me has been the way I think about food waste. I, like many of us, get really excited when I go to the grocery store and like to buy a lot of leafy, fresh things. And I am embarrassed when I am not able to use up all the ingredients I get for certain recipes and sort of quietly throw them away. But, the broader problem of food waste is pretty staggering. I mean, we waste more than a third of all the food grown globally. It is either thrown out in homes or it rots in transit or is thrown out because it doesn't meet aesthetic standards. And, we have very unrealistic expectations about food and how it should look and how much we should be able to eat. And we have an amazingly wasteful society. And that is a big part of the problem. So I've become much more sensitive to, the amount of food we waste in our home. I certainly have become much more sensitive to my own meat consumption. I have tried to be, vegetarian and vegan in the past. I love meat and I've had a really hard time letting it go, but I have become sort of much more willing to accept and sort of experiment with plant-based meat alternatives, and certainly can imagine bringing these cell-based meats or cultured meats into my kitchen when they're ready and affordable, and certainly continuing to eat meat and craft meats and support, meats that are sustainably farmed is great, but I am on a limited budget like so many of us, and so I can't, only buy the really expensive sort of craft artisanal meats, and so I've thought a lot differently about that.
Well, Amanda Little, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much, Terry.
Amanda Little is the author of the new book, The Fate of Food. After we take a short break, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz will review the recording that's now his favorite recording of the year. This is Fresh Air.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Home Instead Senior Care. Gerontologist and caregiver advocate Lakeland Hogan reflects on Home Instead's mission to enhance the lives of aging adults and their families.
You don't stop living once you hit a certain age. You can still live a rich, meaningful life through your later years. And so we are really excited to be celebrating our 25th anniversary at Home Instead and to be still working towards our mission.
To learn more about Home Instead Senior Care, go to homeinstead.com.
Human behavior doesn't always make a ton of sense, at least on the surface.
I said, would you mind if I give the dogs a little piece of cracker with some hot sauce on it and without and see what they choose?
Hidden Brain, a spicy podcast about science, psychology, and why people do what they do.
Can a piece of music be too big for its own good? That's a question our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has been asking himself. He doesn't particularly like grandiosity for its own sake, but in the case of a new recording of what might be the biggest piano concerto ever written, Lloyd thinks the music earns its size.
One of the recordings I've enjoyed most this year is a CD of two famous piano concertos reduced to the size of chamber music. But my new favorite is a recording of what might be the biggest piano concerto ever written. It's by the turn of the 20th century Italian composer and piano virtuoso Ferruccio Busoni, who is probably best known for his adventurous transcriptions of Bach. Most piano concertos clock in at about half an hour or a little more, but the Busoni takes an hour and 10 minutes. It's a fascinating concoction of the serious and the fabulous, the solemn and the pyrotechnic. A concerto not even in the usual three or even four movements. This one is in five, ending with a men's chorus singing in German a Danish poem about spiritual transcendence. I've heard only one live performance of it, almost 30 years ago, by the pianist Garrick Olson and the Cleveland Orchestra. Their marvelous recording is still available. 2 years ago, the Boston Symphony Orchestra, led by the Finnish conductor Sakari Aramo, with the Russian virtuoso Kirill Gerstein, performed this humongous work in Boston, where I live. But I was traveling and had to miss it. That performance has now been released on CD, and I'm blown away by it. Big concertos, like Rachmaninoff's, are usually full of gorgeous tunes played by an inflated orchestra. Paradoxically, the even bigger Busoni concerto has a kind of austerity, the feeling that it needs its vast size in order to work out something that might never get worked out. Instead of being on a Hollywood set, it's more like we're entering a labyrinth. Take this passage in the second movement. I find it bewitching, but what rivets me is the way it seems to be trying to figure out where it's going. Each movement holds new surprises. The first movement is essentially solemn, almost religious in its long-range Wagnerian unfolding. But the second movement is marked playful. The massive third movement depicts a profound crisis, but here's the calm that ends it. And here's the whirlwind tarantella that immediately follows that calm. Finally, with that last choral movement, Busoni calls it a canticle, you feel as if you've been through some large spiritual adventure. Pianist Kirill Gerstein, conductor Sakari Oramo, and the Boston Symphony Orchestra fulfill all of Busoni's impossible demands. If you can manage it, try to listen to the whole work in one sitting, just to see how Busoni's vast scale and astonishing variety really come together as a single extraordinary musical experience.
Lloyd Schwartz teaches in the Masters of Fine Arts program at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. He's also the Poet Laureate of Somerville, Massachusetts. He reviewed the Busoni Piano Concerto with Kirill Gerstein and the Boston Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Sakari Oramo. Tomorrow on Fresh Air, my guest will be Jim DeRogatis, who broke the story of R. Kelly and his underage sexual victims. DeRogatis broke the story of the R. Kelly sex tape, or rape tape, that led to his 2008 trial, and the story of how Kelly led a cult of young girls. DeRogatis has continued to investigate the story, and now he's written a new book called Soulless, The Case Against R. Kelly. I hope you'll join us. I'm Terry Gross.